You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
A year ago, New York Times Police Bureau Chief Al Baker and reporter Ben Mueller began documenting the lives and deaths of each person murdered in New York City's 40th Precinct, a two-square-mile trapezoid at the southern tip of the Bronx, one of several neighborhoods where, despite recent trends, domestic violence and murder rates remain high. Ben Mueller joins us now to discuss their series, which was called Murder in the 4-0. Welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
What are the demographics of the 40th Precinct?
Well, it's part of one of the poorest congressional districts in the United States. Rates of unemployment are high.
How does it compare to Mississippi and Louisiana?
It's actually the poorest congressional district in the country. So
wow.
There's a concentration of poverty there that's persisted through, you know, waves and waves of government attempts to sort of fix the problem there. It has 14 sort of towering public housing developments there, which are dense with people. They often pack three generations of the same family in one apartment. People who have been trying to get out of there, scrapping their whole lives to get out of those apartments and have not been able to and are now living in apartments that are decaying in many cases. You know, jobs are hard to come by. It's changing. There's gentrification creeping in on the southern border, but the precinct as a whole has changed less than many other parts of New York City.
How do the murder rates compare to other parts of the city, and what about Chicago?
It has one of the highest murder rates of any of the precincts in New York City. There was a precinct in Brooklyn that had similar rates, and its overall violent crime rate is the highest of any precinct in the city outside of Midtown Manhattan. Crime overall has dropped there. Murder overall has dropped and is lower, I believe, than in Chicago. But for a 2-square-mile area, 14 murders is still enough to sort of set some fear into people there.
And since crime rates are dropping everywhere else, do people have explanations for why it hasn't happened here?
It's hard to know exactly. I mean, I think part of it is that the economic situation has not changed as much as it has in other parts of the city. The public housing is a driver of crime. These public housing buildings have also created sort of little gangs and crews that are not quite what they used to be. There's these splintered groups that often take young teenagers early on as kind of substitutes for families in many cases that these young men don't have. They eventually get guns to protect themselves, and suddenly they spawn a kind of violence.
What about the police who work in the 40th Precinct? Do they live in the area?
Not many of them do. Many of them live in other parts of the Bronx. Some of them, though, did grow up in public housing in the South Bronx or in Upper Manhattan. They know the place where well and care for it deeply. It's one of the busiest precincts in the city. They refer to it as an A house. So it's sort of one of the busiest spots where you can run around to 25 911 calls on a routine shift. Not enough time to eat, to take breaks.
But I have the sense that there haven't been many efforts to work with the community and build partnerships to reduce crime. Is it just because the precinct is understaffed?
Well, I think that's part of it. I think people are paying attention at few times more than they are after a murder, and they notice how much time detectives can devote to a case. And in the South Bronx, some of the detectives in that precinct have a caseload of 400 or more cases a year. The department advises about 150 cases. And so they have about 4 days to devote exclusively to a murder compared to maybe a month in certain precincts in Manhattan. And so people don't always trust that the police can protect them like they want them to.
And then more police officers have been shot in the 40th precinct than in others.
That's true. It's a dangerous place for their work. You'll talk to cops and they hide under the awnings outside public housing buildings because there's often airmail coming down at them, you know, beer bottles or trash or whatever else. If someone sees a cop standing outside, they've got to watch their backs. And it's in the first 2 months of the year, there were 3 cops shot there. Thankfully, they all survived.
Were the shooters caught?
They were. One of the incidents turned out to be a case of friendly fire with another cop. But there is a flood of police activity when there's a cop shot, understandably. They're sort of trolling public housing buildings, looking for every witness. And some people wonder why they don't see that same police presence, or at least a heavier police presence, when sort of the average person is killed in the South Bronx.
One of your first articles for the series was about the murder of Carmen Torres Gonzalez, and it took place at the Mott Haven houses. How big are the Mott Haven houses, and where are they located in the Bronx?
They're located at the southern end of the precinct, I think around 138th Street. It's like many of these public housing buildings. It's got a sort of big courtyard in the middle with these sort of towering public housing buildings around it. And it creates a space where people, where it's hard for the police to watch what's happening. It feels isolated and disconnected from much of the other, the surrounding streets.
But in this case, weren't there enough warning signs that there might be a problem?
You'd think so. The man who turned out to be the killer had been prosecuted before for what looked like a random attack that seemed to the victims to be motivated by his schizophrenia, his mental illness. He was working as a dishwasher at a restaurant in Manhattan and attacked a coworker with a plate. They prosecuted him, but sort of gave him a second chance, let him off leniently, and no one raised the issue of mental health. He in the months before this killing, he had been seen three times by psychiatric experts at Lincoln Hospital, and each time was released, and it wasn't clear that there was much of a follow-up plan for him or his family to take care of him. He was sleeping in the hallway some nights, he was fighting with his mom, and he was hearing voices. One of the voices he claimed to hear was of the woman he ended up killing, who lived in the apartment right across the street. He ordered a machete from online, hid it under his bed, and this woman became the victim of a kind of terrible buildup of his illness.
Well, you mentioned Lincoln Medical and Mental Health Center, and that also seems to be a big problem. It doesn't seem to deliver the services it's intended to.
Yeah, it's one of the best places if you get shot. You want to go to Lincoln, but you might not want to stay there. It struggles to take care of people over the long term. There was one shooting victim, Bruce Purdy, who ended up dying, who was he was paralyzed from his wound, a gunshot to the back. He stayed at the hospital for a few weeks, was released without, his family said, a treatment plan, any of the follow-up medications he might need to prevent infection. And a few weeks later, sure enough, he's back at the ER at Lincoln Hospital and ends up dying from an after effect of that bullet wound that he was initially treated for.
You wrote that he was a child at government institutions, one half dozen foster homes, a city jail, six state prison facilities, public housing, high-rises. And then at 29, he wound up being shot in recovery care at Lincoln Medical. Sounds like it should be Memorial. It seems like he had everything going against him all along. Do you know why he was shot?
It's not clear. He actually, he was on his bedside with this paralyzing wound. A detective went up to him and showed him a book of all the gang members who were from a rival gang in the Betances houses where he was shot. And Bruce Purdy told the detective he knew who shot him, but he was going to carry that secret by himself. He was going to take care of it himself. He said, "You'll know who shot me when you hear about a man in a wheelchair." He was talking about himself having shot the person who shot me.
Why was he so distrustful of the police? Was he just living to get the revenge, or did he mistrust the cops based on his life experiences?
Unfortunately, we cannot talk to him, so I don't know what was going on in his head. But when you talk to people in the South Bronx, it's a place that had some of the highest rates of stop and frisk. So many young men were stopped and searched for what, for ultimately no reason or no criminal reason. And he had been at the losing end of a web of government neglect. He was in foster homes that failed him. His mother had struggled with drug addiction during the crack epidemic in New York City. He had gone from one government institution to another. He was in public housing buildings that were poorly taken care of. The street he was shot on had no lights, no cameras. It was only a block from the big park where Bernie Sanders actually spoke at a rally during his presidential campaign. But it was in a kind of void as far as the city's public safety net is concerned.
I'm speaking with Ben Mueller, who, with New York Times Police Bureau Chief Al Baker, has written a series called Murder in the 4-0, which refers to the 40th Precinct in the South Bronx. In the case of Mr. Purdy, he insisted on being released, even though his doctor didn't think that was a good idea. Was it because he felt he was not receiving good care, or just wanted to go out there and try to track down the man who had shot him?
I think he was itching to get out because it was not a comfortable place to be. He shot some cell phone videos that that we saw during his hospital stay. And in one, he's sitting in a pile of his own stool, and he's complaining that the door's open, visitors are walking by, he can't seem to get anyone's attention to get him help. In another video, he's kind of quarreling with doctors and social workers about when they'll let him out. He says, "I'm confused. You're telling me different things day by day. I haven't seen you in 5 days. When am I going to get a plan?" And they sort of say, "Well, it was the weekend. What do you think you need when you go home? Like, what do you want?" And he's baffled. And this is not, you know, he's not someone who's comfortable in this setting, clearly, and it showed.
So they just let him lay there in his own excrement?
For how long, I don't know. But for, you know, on this cell phone video he shot, there was a pile of stool next to him. And he you know, it's very hard to deal with victims of a paralyzing gun wound. And you need a rehabilitation center. He only had public insurance, and that made it harder for him to get a bed at a better facility that would have cared for him.
You showed those videos to another trauma team. What was their response?
Their response was that, you know, that they understood the challenges, the strain those doctors are under. They get a lot of the most serious cases and don't have a lot of help. But they said it looked like that the doctors could have done more, been clearer, been more sort of accommodating to someone who came from a background where he was distrustful of the doctors and the police, but needed help.
And to get attention, he even set his sheets on fire at one point. Shouldn't he have just been transferred to a facility that might have been able to help him more?
That's what doctors say would have been the solution. But doctors at that hospital, in fact, one of the doctors who helped care for him said it's exceedingly more difficult to get someone a bed at a private rehabilitation center if they're on Medicaid. And so he struggled to get that help.
Did the police have any idea who did shoot him?
They're still working on it. They've gotten a few more tips. There was actually another man's story we ended up writing about later in the year who lived in one of those buildings right near where Bruce Purdy was shot. And he had made a number of complaints about drug activity outside his home, and said he actually picked up some talk of people talking about who had killed this man, Bruce Purdy. But this witness described not wanting to go to the police because he couldn't get their help on the drug crimes he was worried about.
We should point out that the killing of Bruce Purdy is something that took a time. He was shot, and then he died of those wounds a while later.
He was shot. He died of the wounds a while later. He actually died in December of 2015. Then what happens is the chief medical examiner does a study of what caused his death. And there are primary causes and secondary causes and tertiary causes. And they eventually trace the sort of fatal blood clot that killed him all the way back to that paralyzing gunshot wound. So it was counted as a homicide on the 40th Precinct's rolls for 2016.
Now, he had had his run-ins with the law, but the woman we talked about earlier, Carmen Torres Gonzalez, she just was somebody who just was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and a person with mental health issues heard voices and decided to stab her?
Yeah, she was one of the more generous people on the floor. She would bring her favorite salami soup that she cooked to neighbors. In fact, when she saw this man sleeping, the man who ended up killing her, sleeping in the hallway right outside her mother's apartment, she offered him help too and said, "Do you need something to eat?" She tried to reach out to folks, and for that, you know, she drew the man's attention and she was killed. It's a very sort of cramped living space where she was trying to have a conversation with her mother's caregiver was only steps from this man's apartment, and so people are sort of living on top of each other in some cases.
A fair number of the stories that you tell here involve people who really were not involved in any criminal activity, just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, wind up being shot by stray bullets or killed by abusive husbands who they have already reported, but didn't seem to get any help in dealing with.
Domestic violence is one of the sort of a major persistent strain of violence in the 40th Precinct and around the city. It's a hard one for the police to get a handle on because it often happens outside of their view. But in some of the cases we wrote about, the woman who ended up becoming the victim had sought a restraining order, had called the police, that the person was on their radar screen, but they weren't able to do enough. And often, as you said, that perpetrator was in and out of hospitals dealing with mental health issues.
And we'll talk about her. That's Nadja Saavedra.
Right.
After we take a little break, my guest is Ben Mueller, who with New York Times Police Bureau Chief Al Baker given us a series on the 40th precinct of the South Bronx called Murder in the 40. Stay with us for more. We're back with New York Times reporter Ben Mueller, who, with New York Times Police Bureau Chief Al Baker, has given us a series about what goes on in the 40th precinct in the South Bronx. The series is called Murder in the 40. We were just starting to talk about what happened, something you reported in April, the death of Nadja Savidja. Her husband, Alejandro Uribe, killed her. Hadn't she asked him to move out because he'd been abusive for years?
That's true. She had worried to family members about his abuse, and she eventually, toward the very end of her life, sought help from the authorities. She got a restraining order, but the burden falls heavily on domestic violence victims like her to go extra steps to secure themselves, and so she didn't quite take all the steps that the police would have needed to make an arrest if he had come near her apartment. She also wanted him to stay involved. I mean, he was staying involved in their children's lives, and that meant he was around and in touch with their son. It was difficult for them to disentangle their lives.
They had two kids, yeah. And she was only 34. Yeah. And then he killed her and committed suicide. What happened to the kids? Were they witnesses to this?
I believe one of the children walked in soon after and saw part of what had happened. They had other family members who, you know, quickly took the kids in and tried to get them help. But it's, you know, it's something we came upon again and again. Children are often the witnesses to these crimes, just as the murder victims we write about were often the witnesses to their own parents getting in legal trouble or criminal trouble. They now have children who are watching the violence play out in their homes and on their streets, and very rarely getting help. There was one, you know, a young child whose father was killed later on in the year, who went back to school without a therapist's help. Was quite troubled by the episode and ended up having to be sent to a psychiatric institute in Westchester. But that's not the solution that I think anyone wants. And you know, families wish they could get a little more of the city's help for the victims of crime in the aftermath, especially young ones.
Poverty, alcoholism, and drug abuse can often go hand in hand with domestic violence. Do we know if there's more domestic violence in the 40th precinct than in most other parts of the city?
It is, I believe, one of the worst precincts for domestic violence. The Bronx as a whole is at higher rates of domestic violence than in any other borough.
Is this the responsibility of the police?
I don't think it's only their responsibility. They would certainly say they work within a network of help, and part of that is the city hospitals that see abuse victims often earlier on, or see perpetrators at earlier stages of their mental illness. It's something that requires a sort of web of help, and if any link in that chain is broken, some people can fall through the cracks.
One of your next articles was about a man named Roberto Rodriguez. Who was he?
He was a young man living in an area around Cortland Avenue, which is has been a tough corner for the police there for a long time. He was an immigrant,
from Mexico.
Yes, from Mexico. And he became sort of enamored of this life of guns and drugs and crews, and became somewhat aimless. He was killed late one night in a sort of drunk-fueled, alcohol-fueled fight that spilled through this corner in the South Bronx.
Had he been able to get work? He was just 30 years old when this happened.
Yeah, he had gotten a bit of work here and there, I believe, but like many of the victims we wrote about, was struggling to keep a job. Was sort of moving through these homes where drugs were being sold out of, and there was prostitution involved too, and so he was living a dangerous life.
And he kind of lost his way after his wife left him for his brother-in-law.
That's true. He had been trying to hold on to, you know, some long-distance relationships from home, it was an example of the kind of immigrant story that. You know, he faced a lot of struggles that a lot of immigrants face later on in their journeys.
And he and a friend, Lazaro Martinez, were both hurt in this brawl, but Lazaro was the only one who was sent to the emergency room.
Right. It was a chaotic scene after they were stabbed. it wasn't clear that there was a police officer who spoke Spanish who was on the scene initially, which made it very hard for them to understand what was happening. But Lazaro looked like he had the more serious wound. He got sent to the hospital sooner, and you can see on a cell phone video that someone shot the victim walking, sort of staggering around. He's trying to help people, and only minutes into this does he finally stumble to the ground, and the second ambulance come to take him away.
So it seemed that it was just a fist fight, but Roberto was killed because for other reasons, right? He had been willing to testify against somebody for another murder that he had witnessed.
It's not clear. There was this other case hanging in the background where he had done a somewhat courageous thing and stepped up and named a perpetrator in a different crime, and that, some of his friends said, it put a sort of target on his back. And it was hard in that case and in many for the police and for us to untangle what all was, you know, what sort of drove the crime in the end. There are often a number of feuds and disagreements and sort of criminal rivalries in the background of people's lives that don't seem like they should lead to murder, but can.
In all these cases, you're telling the stories of the victims. Some of the victims were totally innocent of any criminal activity on their own. Others were engaged in criminal activity. But why did you feel it was necessary to tell a story that way?
For a long time, I had been writing sort of very short, cursory kind of stories about murders that happened across the city, and they gave very little insight into who was killed, the sort of human fallout from that, what the police were doing about it or not doing about it.
What happens to the kids?
Sure, what happens to the kids and why someone gets killed. I mean, at an age of record low crime, what are the reasons? The drug dealing is happening in less visible ways. The sort of big national gangs don't have as much power as they used to. Why are people getting killed in 2016 in New York City? And this was a chance to tell those stories more deeply.
And were you surprised by some of the things that you discovered?
Sure. I mean,
a couple of these stories sound like they would make movies or interesting novels.
Sure. Every person had a story behind them. I think one of the things that was surprising was over the course of our series, and especially in looking at some of those cases of innocent women who were killed, innocent people who were killed, there was a lot of frustration on the streets about the police presence there and about the size of the police presence, and it was jarring to ultimately come up with some numbers that are confidential, you know, held closely by the police department, that show just the kind of neglect that happens there.
Did you go to Mexico to find out more about the circumstances of Roberto's childhood?
I didn't personally, but we had reporters on the ground in Mexico and Ecuador in a few of the cases, who went to family homes, who saw funerals, that watched bodies being transported back home, and I think it helped see the sort of full life cycle of one of these people and the way the fallout from this violence stretches across continents. And you know, they were often seen as the people who could help family back home. They were held out as big hopes, and when it went wrong for them in the South Bronx, which is a community of a lot of immigrants, it hit hard back in their home countries.
I'm speaking with New York Times reporter Ben Mueller, who about a series called Murder in the 4-0 that he wrote with New York Times Police Bureau Chief Al Baker. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Another article in the series is about Jessica White. Also, these people are incredibly young when they die. She was 28, a mother of three, and her father and older sister had been killed in an apartment fire in 1997 when she was just nine, so she already had experienced quite a bit of tragedy.
And her brother, only 4 years before she was killed in the John Adams houses, had been also shot and killed in that same exact housing project. Her mother had buried her son 4 years ago in 2012, bought a space for another tombstone, which she figured would be hers when she eventually died, and ended up having to bury her own daughter, another child of hers, in the space she had reserved for herself. It was enormous tragedy for this family, all in the space of this one big public housing complex.
Jessica had five stays in homeless shelters, but then got a job at Shake Shack and was finally able to get a place of her own.
Yeah, things were looking up for her, and just before she was killed, that's what she was talking to her mother about, how she had hopes to get her own place finally, to move somewhere safer with her kids. She was watching her kids play on the playground on a sort of very warm summer night. The apartment was too hot and stuffy, so they were out out enjoying, you know, the cool with a lot of people out there. And someone walked up along the walkway and shot her.
By accident?
Yeah, he was aiming for someone else, and it was very hard for the police to figure out exactly who. They had some guesses, but didn't quite know for sure.
Don't they usually offer a reward for tips on murders like that?
They do routinely. In this case, the reward was $2,500, which is the bare minimum for a case like this.
So people just didn't feel it was worth the money if they were going to put themselves in danger?
It's not clear quite how much, you know, I think a lot of it was also just people not trusting the cops for all the reasons, some of the reasons we've alluded to. I think they felt that there wasn't, they didn't see many cops out there afterward. They didn't feel like the police, you know, were sort of flooding the neighborhood like they sometimes do. In another case of an innocent woman who was killed in Queens around the same time this past summer, the reward was considerably higher. The mayor's office immediately put down $10,000 on top of $15,000, I think, from the police. And you know, Jessica's family looked at that and wondered whether race was playing a factor in how the police and the city give out reward money like this.
Are there security cameras in these playgrounds?
There wasn't one right in the playground. There were a couple on the outside of the building and in the elevator that helped the police get a picture of the man who eventually killed Jessica. It was not a clear enough image for them to. They still haven't made an arrest in the case. But the families often complain that there are not cameras on every single public housing building outside, and families often wish there were, in addition to lights and working doors and things like that.
And what happens to these children? Her three children.
Well, they're with their father, who took them in, and he lives in a different public housing complex nearby. The children saw what happened, especially the older one was right there. She's, in fact, like her father has shown pictures from Facebook of people he's heard might be involved in the killing, and asked her does she recognize this man from that night out on the playground. So they're going through a lot. Their father tried to keep them distracted, take them to movies. They're in a loving home, but it's incredibly difficult for these kids.
Your most recent article is about the death of Maribel Cavero, who is just 45, when she was shot unintentionally.
Yes.
She was just crossing the street.
She had just dropped off some sugar substitute to a family member and was going to pick up her niece from school. And a bullet flew several city blocks through trees and wires and ended up hitting her. In this case, the police came out in force, and the person who the bullet was intended for, unlike in the case of Jessica White, actually walked into the police precinct and said, "That bullet was meant for me," which is an unusual thing for the police to see there.
This was 12:50 in the afternoon. We all could have been killed that way. So do we know why they even shot at this guy?
The man who was the intended target made some reference to a dispute related to marijuana and payments over marijuana. He wasn't quite clear about what exactly the reason was, though.
But then the cops did identify the shooter right away, a 17-year-old kid. Was he having a midday gunfight? He was just trying to kill that guy?
Apparently. The police, you know, were helped by the fact that one of the detectives actually knew the perpetrator's mother, so they knew the family, and another of the detectives had actually recognized the perpetrator on video because he had arrested a family member of his before. So this is a case where it helped. The detectives knew the neighborhood deeply, had formed relationships with people.
But this seems to be rather unusual.
You're right. It is. It's the kind of crime that was more common decades ago in New York City, when there were innocent bystanders getting killed. It doesn't happen much. But when there's this kind of gunplay happening in broad daylight with people out going about their days and kids coming home from school, it can happen.
Unfortunately, it sounds like the kind of a series that could just go on and on and on.
Unfortunately, it could.
Will you be covering the 40th in the near future?
Well, we're paying attention to a number of things that came out of our reporting, among them the sort of stark imbalances in resources that the city has put in the 40th precinct and in the Bronx as a whole. So we've been following that story, and we'll continue to follow what the city does about it, if anything.
Is it just a matter of money or of attitude?
Certainly part of it is attitude. Part of it is a history of police tactics that have alienated people, especially in neighborhoods like the South Bronx, with things like Stop and Frisk and something called Operation Impact, where they flooded neighborhoods with rookie cops who had to produce numbers of arrests and summonses before they focused on other things. And a big part of it is that detectives in the South Bronx have considerably higher caseloads than other parts of the city.
Are you hopeful, given the more robust response that happened when Maribel died? Do you think that to some degree was because of the series in the Times?
It's hard to say, but I think one of the factors in this ecosystem of neglect is the news media, and the news media rarely writes about killings in the South Bronx with the same persistence and attention it does a killing in Manhattan or something, and I think that makes it easier for, you know, the white shirts down at police headquarters to pay a little less attention to what's happening there. I think when we shine a spotlight like this, it helps make sure the people are getting the services they need.
Well, you work for the New York Times. Isn't that the responsibility of the assignment desk?
Sure, and
why do you think the newspapers are not just the Times, but I guess all the papers, don't pay as much attention? Could we say that's also a matter of race and class?
Perhaps, and I think it has to do with what surprises us and what doesn't. When someone with a criminal history is killed in the South Bronx, I think for an assignment editor, it feels like a less surprising, less unexpected instance. Whereas if someone's killed in Manhattan, I think it also has to do with, you know, hitting closer to the centers of power in the city. It's big financial institutions and government institutions and media institutions. We're all in Manhattan for the most part. So the tabloids do cover these outer borough killings, but no one really spends as much time on them as we would on the case of a police officer who was shot or an innocent woman who was killed in some part of the city.
Somebody who had more money than these people.
Sure, that's a big part of it.
Ben Mueller and New York Times Police Bureau Chief Al Baker collaborated on a series for the Times called Murder in the 4-0. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thanks for having me.